News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it's been another great, great week in technology. The iPhone 5S and 5C is out.
I'm really curious to hear what you think, particularly the 5C.
The 5C, and we'll talk about the camera.
Oh.
A big, big upgrade in the camera.
In both phones or just the...
Just the 5C, and they put a lot of...
In the cheaper one?
Oh, no, the 5S.
The 5S.
Sorry, yeah,
okay,
5S. Yeah, the more expensive one. Yeah, the 5S, and it's very similar to the process things you'll get in a high-end digital single-lens reflex.
No kidding.
Pretty nifty what they're doing there with that, because they got a 64-bit processor. They got a lot more processing time. And, of course, we got a huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Let's get this up here.
Okay,
it's a big mailbag.
It must have rocks
in
there,
right,
too.
We got an email from Wayne Boyer. He's from Tucson, Arizona. He's another podcast listener, actually. Dear Tech Doc, I plan to replace my hard drive in my desktop with a solid-state drive. I currently use a Macrom Reflect to image my drive and would like to install the image to a new drive. Is there any setting that I need any changes that I need to make in the BIOS, when I make this change? Is there any good procedure that I should follow? Love your show. Listen to it every week via podcast. Wayne H. Boyer, Tucson, Arizona. Well, Wayne, the good news is no BIOS changes will actually be required. The solid-state drives are available on a variety of system interfaces. So what happens is it has a hardware piece there that transforms the solid-state drive signals to some sort of standard interface. So your computer just thinks it's a regular old hard drive. And because frequently these are used in conjunction with or interchangeable with magnetic disk drives. And so the solid-state drives come in all types of common interfaces, SATA, Fiber Channel, SAS, or the old ATA, IDA. You can even get a solid-state drive with a USB output if you want to plug it in as an external drive. You got a lot of different interfaces. The type of interface you have really depends on the speed of the solid-state drive. So the old ATA, IDA, IDE is the sort of the slowest one. More than likely, it's going to be an SATA, SATA interface, and you just simply have to make certain that your laptop supports the interface that your solid-state drive, is connected to, and then you just plop it in there, and your actual it's just going to look like a magnetic drive to your computer. Now, if you want to leave the old drive in your desktop as kind of a backup drive, and if you want to boot on the solid-state drive, you are going to have to go into the BIOS and select a different boot disk, so it will boot up on the solid-state drive instead of on the old drive. That's really just a configuration. So you just go into the BIOS and go into the boot sequence, and you can select that. But it's a relatively easy shift, and the solid-state drive manufacturers have really designed it to make it easy because they want you to do exactly what you are doing. We got an email from Hawk and Bowie.
Uh-oh, she has ties to those Ohio people, doesn't she?
That is a problem. That is a problem. Yes, indeed. Dear Tech Talk, can Google or any other search engine accumulate data on my searches or internet activity? If I don't have a Google account, I'm worried that someone may be watching what I do on the internet.
I knew this is going to be a problem.
Yeah. I don't know what it is with that crew. Love the show, Hawk and Bowie.
Crazy stuff.
Well, Hawk, when you access any website, the server gets a fair amount of information from your connection
yeah.
to that server and from your browser. Now, this could be the IP address where you're at, the type of browser you're using, its settings, any cookies that were set prior to visits to the site, and possibly some other information. Now, that actually kind of creates a digital fingerprint. So they have a pretty good idea when you go back in there that, you know, this computer, where it's located, the browser. And so they could pretty much identify you, even though they wouldn't identify you by name.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some years ago, search engine data was made available to researchers. They wanted to see whether researchers could figure out who was doing the searches. So they filtered all the IP addresses. They made all the data anonymous. But it turns out that people kind of search for things that kind of give a clue of who they are.
Yeah.
And so it turned out that by cross-referencing the search, these researchers were able to get a pretty good idea of who was doing the searching, even though they didn't exactly know it. So, so the fact is, even though you don't have an account with Gmail specifically, they could probably track down what you're doing from that computer if they wanted to. Now, chances are, nobody's really going to be interested in exactly what you're searching mm-hmm. on your, you know, except folks from Tech Talk.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But now, so you don't really have to worry about it unless you're doing, you know, nuclear secrets or something. But this privacy issue is becoming a larger and larger issue because these companies are keeping the search data for a long time, and with the new government program PRISM, they're actually turning that data over, and they're really unable not to turn over the data. So Google was keeping that data because they wanted to deliver ads that you would be interested in. So they keep track of the kind of things that you're searching, and then all of a sudden ads related to those things start popping up. And that's viewed as a feature for you and also a real advantage to the Google advertisers.
Sure.
So that's why they keep the data, not really to spy on you. But then with the PRISM situation coming up, the government could get it and spy on you. So,
and we see how that works out these days, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, there are some real issues here. And later in the show, I'll get into some recent court cases relating to this. It'll give us some small update in terms of what's going on. We got an email from DQ. Dear Tech Talk, I want to buy the ideal wireless mouse and keyboard combo for my laptop. Either the mouse that I had, either I found the perfect mouse with all the functionality, or I found the perfect keyboard. But I actually couldn't find a combo that had both.
Huh.
So I have to buy them separately. But I don't want to have two USB connectors. You know how these wireless things,
yes.
you plug in a USB?
Yeah.
So is it possible to have two, you know, not get the combo and have mouse A and keyboard B, but only use one wireless USB port on my laptop? Well, here's the thing. First of all, I check whether your laptop had Bluetooth. Then you may not even need a USB connection. And then, you know, if you have Bluetooth, you could just get a Bluetooth mouse and a Bluetooth keyboard, and then there's no issue. Now, if you have an older laptop, you probably don't have Bluetooth, so you are going to have to get a wireless connection. It turns out that all of the wireless peripheral manufacturers have gotten smart enough that they have all their devices support the same standard. So, like, if you go to Logitech, all the Logitech devices, the mice, the wireless mice, the wireless keyboard, all support the same standard. Now, these are non-Bluetooth devices. They all support the same standard, so you don't have to necessarily get the combo deal. But unfortunately, the standard that they pick is sort of manufacturer-specific.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't get a wireless Logitech device and a wireless Microsoft device and have it work on the same thing. You're going to have
sure.
to stick within the same manufacturer. But it is possible. And it sounds like, since you're kind of a techie guy, that you probably just could use Bluetooth anyway. We got an email from John in Reston. Dear Doc and Jim, I just got a new laptop and have trouble seeing the fonts. Can I make the screen larger on my Windows 7 laptop? Thanks, mm-hmm. John from Reston. Well, John, I had the same problem. We got a new laptop at work, and they installed it. I'm telling you, the fonts were just so tiny. I could hardly read them. I mean, maybe
sit across the room.
Maybe 25 years ago I could have read them, but But so what you do is, now changing your screen resolution is really the wrong thing to do. What you want to do, you want your screen resolution to be the native resolution of your monitor. So like if it's 1920 by 1200, that's a typical one, just leave it there.
Okay.
Like if you try to make the image bigger and stretch it, say to make it 1280 by 1024, then what happens? Each pixel fills a pixel and a half. I mean, it doesn't exactly map into it exactly right.
No, and it looks the resolution is off, right?
It looks bigger, but then it looks fuzzy.
Because your display is
trying to figure this out, and it goes one way one time and another time when it sort of collects the imaging. So you want to match the resolution of your monitor. So don't make it bigger that way. What you want to do is there is a way to change the font size just by itself, leaving the resolution the same. So what you want to do is right click on your desktop. So you go to the desktop, right click and a menu will come up and click screen resolution. In Windows 7, that's what it. And then once another window will come up, and you'll see something that says "Make text or other items larger or smaller." Click on that, and you have a choice of going 100, 125, or 150% bigger on the text. Actually, I went to 125%. That's what I found. I was really happy with.
It's like reading glasses for
you.
Yeah,
it is kind of reading glasses. Now, maybe you want to have it like 170%, and so if you don't like those three choices, then you can actually right click on that thing, and when you click on make text larger or smaller, and look at that menu, there's something at the bottom called custom set custom DPI link, dots per inch link, and then you can go there and you can set any percentage. You don't have to go with 100, 125, or 150.
Right.
I found that 150, 125 worked well for me. And then what I did in my browser, I set the browser view at 125. And so the browser view at 125 combined with the 125 text fonts was all I needed. I was quite happy. Now, some applications actually let you use control key, like control plus or control minus. So sometimes if you're in the browser, you can hit control plus and it just makes it bigger. Or control minus, it makes it smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the browsers or email programs, in addition to control plus, control minus, will allow you to use the little scroll wheel, and you can make the image bigger or smaller. So that's a way if you just want to make the image bigger or smaller while you're browsing or looking at one of your email programs. But that's a very nice question.
It's the same question.
It's the same problem that I had previously. So you were having some issues, Jim.
I heard you had some issues. I meant to send you an email last night, but I fell asleep, which is funny because I fell asleep, and you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to prepare this show.
That's right. So if you'd have sent it to me last night at 2, I'd have gotten it.
But I think you're going to have the answers to these anyway. Let's start with Bluetooth, with the iPad that I have. I'd like to know if I can use both a Bluetooth speaker and a Bluetooth keyboard at the same time with the iPad. Is that going to work?
Oh, yeah, that'd work. The standard Bluetooth technology is going to support multiple devices.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you can, say, a laptop, you could have a keyboard and a mouse. And that's kind of a standard two-device deal. It supports that. Now, what it won't allow you to do is have two audio channels at the same time. You couldn't put a headphone and a speaker on. You'd have to choose one or the other. But you can easily support it. Now, some people get a little confused because they actually have to pair the devices. So they might pair one device and the other device doesn't work, and so they say it's not working. So you have to pair each device separately.
It can be a little tricky. You have to kind of mess around a little bit when you're pairing with it in the settings on the device, right?
And you have to make the device discoverable.
Right.
So you have to put it in a state where it's discoverable, and then once it's discoverable, they talk, and then you have to put a code in to do the pairing. And, I mean, it's not really that complicated, but it's complicated enough that maybe 25% of the people can't really successfully do it.
This is where reading the instruction comes in really handy, I think.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I've actually paired a Bluetooth keyboard to my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to do, but I was just curious if I could do it.
I could put
my iPhone on a little stand, and I was actually able to type documents very fast with my iPhone.
It's not ridiculous. It's way more efficient, especially if you're on the go all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why I got the iPad Mini, was so that I could work on documents, because as much as I love the iPhone and as many things mm-hmm. that it does, the keypad is just so small. And it's funny because now that I've got this, I do more texting on the iPad than I do on the iPhone because it takes me forever to accurately type things on the iPhone. So the keyboard makes all the sense in the world.
So for my iPad, I do have a Bluetooth keyboard for my iPad, and it and the iPad just fits right in. It's one of those. Once it's all integrated together, it's a cover and everything. It is fantastic.
Yeah.
So now when I travel, I really don't need a laptop anymore. I just the iPad with the keyboard becomes my laptop.
Exactly. As you said, and now with the cloud, you don't need to be carrying around thumb drives and disks and all kinds of stuff.
You don't need any of that. The only problem is we don't really have good document generation tools yet. I mean, you've got the Apple, imitation of the Office suite, but it's really not as good as Microsoft Office on there. And so if I'm going to make something really complicated, heavily formatted document, I'm still going to go back to the PC. But just for simple, light formatted, very simply formatted documents without a lot of tables, just bold and stuff. The iPad's perfect for that.
And as you've talked about in the past, when we do some of the back-to-school shows, and you talk about buying kids laptops, the iPad and the tablets have become really great at that because when kids lug around all these books to classes and stuff, the last thing you want is a huge laptop to be going with it. So a keyboard and an iPad or a mini iPad or something like that is a great option for things like this.
It works pretty well. A lot of schools are going to also the Chromebooks.
And you know what? A lot of schools ban clearly phones and devices from the classroom. But now a lot of places, as you have in your workspace, are going to bring your own device. It's just the way that we're going now.
It works. It works much, much better.
I heard a parent say last week, I don't know why I'm buying paper notebooks anymore because kids take all their notes on their device and save it that way.
They take the device. And now we're now at Stratford University. We've gone to 70% e-books. We're gradually transitioning to 100% e-books, but there are just some books that there's some reference books. Especially cookbooks and things like that, they just don't lend themselves so much to the e-book deal. But I tell you, the e-books are really convenient, and then they're all embedded right into our online platform. So the students log into their online account for that particular class, and the book is right there, and they can read it. But you know what else happens?
What's that?
Now the teacher can tell how long they spend with the book.
No kidding.
Because there's feedback to the instructor.
Huh.
And he says, oh, I see you've only spent 10 minutes reading your book this last week. And so these tools are now used to measure student engagement.
So you encourage students to bring tablets and things like that to the classroom, right?
And they can read their book, yeah, sure. Now, we don't like them to surf the web in class.
No.
See, this is actually always the problem.
Well, that will come out in the end when they don't pass the exams,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but that is. So many teachers really don't have so much computer work in class because there is a tendency to surf the web a little too much when you've got internet access.
So what is your policy? Can kids bring devices to your classes?
Yeah, it's up to the teacher to enforce it.
Really?
I don't have a central...
Uh-huh.
I don't have a central enforcing rule. I mean, I let instructors do what's best for that particular class, and it varies with the class.
Interesting. Now, obviously, you have several different academic fields that you're involved in, but in the technology field, in specific, how does that work? I mean, you guys—they're sitting in a computer lab, though, when you're doing IT stuff, right?
Yeah, they're sitting in the computer lab, and a lot of the a lot of what they get comes up as a disk image right off our central servers. So we have thin clients set up there. So they're in a computer lab, but all the computers have internet access.
So how do you feel about this, on a lower academic level, for instance, in junior high and high school, the ability for kids to bring devices to the classroom? Is this a good learning tool, or is this more of a distraction at this point?
If the teacher is trained, they can be outstanding learning tools. Where the kids can actually do research. See what the new trend is kind of this flip the classroom where the kids they read their book and they look at the lecture stuff at home.
Right.
And then when they come to class, they actually work on real problems. So the teacher, if they're working on actually real problems and they're looking up information on the internet while they're solving the problem, the teacher can be there to help them. So having these resources in the classroom if the teacher knows how to use them, can be very effective. Mm-hmm. The problem has been in, say, K through 12, frequently they just launched all these devices. They didn't train the teachers, and they found out that actually kids learned less.
Interesting.
Because they were kind of playing with them, but they weren't integrated into the curriculum in a proper way.
But in the way that the real world is evolving, that people are using these devices in the business world, wouldn't it seem more... Would it make more sense in the classroom setting so that we're training kids that these are not just things to play games on, but you can do real work on these?
You can. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's certainly legitimate. And our librarians, our learning resource centers, they actually spend a lot of time on information literacy, showing kids how to look up information and mm-hmm. assess this. There's a lot to that. But, you know... Class time, too, is really used for discussion, for critical thinking, and so sometimes having the computer there is not necessarily – it's like, have you ever seen people at a four people at dinner, and they're all looking at their smartphone and
not
talking?
And paying attention to each other.
Yeah.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So I'm actually becoming – we have a lot of technology, but I'm sort of coming down on the fact that having – debates and discussions and looking at problems from multiple directions is in a classroom discussion is probably more productive than looking at the devices.
And that's how you develop critical thinking, right?
That's how you develop critical thinking, because what we found at Stratford is that people get promotions because of critical thinking, and so. You get your core skills and then you get your initial job, but then you run into things that you've never seen before, and you've got to think it through in a logical way to draw mm-hmm. a conclusion. And it turns out that people that have clarity of thought and know how to think through a process, you know, looking at the eight elements of critical thinking, think through the process and draw a conclusion, they have confidence in that conclusion, so that then they're able to speak it with confidence, and that you know shows that a leadership sort of trait, and they're the ones selected for promotion. So the critical thinking skills and the soft skills get the promotion, the hard skills get the initial job. So we try to do a lot of that built right into the program, and that's actually what employers want worldwide. They want students to do that.
So it sounds like the way things work now is that you do the homework first, and then you put it into practice in the next class section. Is that correct?
Yeah. Many of our classes are run that way. Mm-hmm. And so you actually have a lot of group discussions. Because let's face it, lectures, I mean, kids just do... Do they really pay attention during a lecture?
Probably not.
So what you want to do is you want to have a short lecture with a lot of group work. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have all lecture. Some lecture is actually critical, but then you want to have a lot of group work that actually engages the students. And I like to say the true value of education is what's left after you've forgotten everything you memorized.
Interesting.
In other words, how did it change the way you think?
Right, how it wires your brain to
solve problems.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right.
So the other question was, we talked early in the summer about smart watches, and I recall that basically your takeaway from that was that smart watches really aren't soup yet. They're probably not worth spending the money on. Is there anything out there now? I'm looking for something as a gift that would be compatible with an Apple device. Is there anything out there? Is it worth it? And if not, is Apple going to get into this game?
I think Apple is very close to releasing their iWatch.
Really?
Yeah, they're very close to that. It's rumored to be about $300.
Uh-huh.
It's a little on the steep side.
Uh-huh.
But they're rumored to do that. There was this Pebble smartwatch that was crowdsourced that we talked about a while ago. And so you really there are other smartwatches that work with the Android, and you have to decide what you want the smartwatch to do. I mean, you really don't want to browse the internet with your watch.
It's too small.
And the other thing, these smartwatches all look a little clunky because you've got to have they're fairly big.
Yeah.
So and so some of them. And it doesn't really make sense to talk into your watch like the Dick Tracy watch.
Inspector Gadget.
So the smartwatch is really not used for, I think, talking. I mean, you're still going to answer the phone. But many of them have a button on them where if you decide you don't want to answer the phone, you can just, you know, press the button, shut it off. What's very nice is that you can read text messages that come through to your, so you can sit there instead of, you know, and it's a pain when, you know, it's, you know, you watch somebody always looking at their text messages.
You can,
so they can kind of look down at their watch and they can read their text messages. It's like a secret way to look at text messages.
I think she's interested in it for that, for Twitter, also probably to listen to music on while she's on the go.
Yeah, I guess you, but you would, but the thing is you still have to have your iPhone
To pair with it.
Well, see, so you've got an iPhone speaker, so I'm not convinced that
That's
listening
true.
To music even makes any sense.
Yeah.
So what I've seen is you can control the music.
It's sort of like a remote control.
Yeah, so you've got like start, stop, go to the next item. So it's really, I don't think it really makes sense for it to have a speaker in it, for it to have a microphone in it. It just controls your iPhone. And I'm not convinced they figured out a real useful application
for the smartwatch
that would actually, in the long term, just be something to say, boy, I've just got to have that. I mean, the smartwatches are so big, you could almost just get.
How big are they? They're so big.
They're probably an inch, you know, an inch and a quarter.
Well, I think she kind of likes the chunky, geeky aspect of that.
So the ultimate smartwatch, Jim, would be to just get a wristband and put your entire smartphone on your wrist.
If I had my iPad Nano the iPod Nano, actually did make a watch band for that. And
you could
course,
do that. And then you could actually get a clock face for your iPhone, so you'd have this giant face on your iPhone, and then you can see the text messages directly.
Or you could go to like the world map that they have on there with the different time zones. That would look kind of cool.
That's right.
Except you break your wrist.
So I think if she's really into this total slick integration with the iPhone, I'd wait for the iWatch to come out because it's imminent.
It's
imminent.
Really? Wow.
So what they're saying is that it's in the same rumor roundup as the 5S, 5C. So it's very close.
Wow.
It's very close. But I don't think they released it last week.
No, they didn't. Just the S and the C.
So just the S and the C. But it is getting very close. And so I'll bet it's out before Christmas.
No kidding. Well, that would make sense from a marketing standpoint.
I'm thinking it's going to be out before Christmas. And so I'm thinking that is going to be the way to go. So there's been rumors of this for a long, long time. And, you know, it's going to be a 1.5 to 2 inch display.
Wow, still big. You're like carrying a jumbotron on your wrist.
And it's also going to have biometric functionality.
That I think she'd like.
So you can be used as a fitness tracking device.
She'd love that because she has the Nike thing on her.
Oh, it's not going to debut till the end of 2014. I'm just looking. So it's a little bit.
Thanks for getting me all worked up. Christmas.
I was only off by one year.
One Christmas.
Okay, it's going to be there for Christmas of 2014.
Gotcha.
So you could get the Pebble device, which is a cheaper device, and you could get that as kind of tied over until the iWatch comes out.
And that way she could, that'd be fun.
And play around with it. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Very good. Doc, you are doing more than just conducting the Classroom of the Air.
I am tracking Tech Talk Online on Facebook. So go to facebook.com/Tech Talk Online. We'll look at your comments during the show. Also, we love your emails. Send emails to techtalk@stratford.edu.
This is indeed Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Apple. application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
And this week in Profiles in IT, we're going to talk about Admiral Grace Murray Hopper. Now, she's called Amazing Grace because she did so much in her lifetime. Now, Amazing Grace Hopper was born December 9th, 1906, to Walter and Mary Murray in New York City. She got a bachelor's in arts in mathematics and physics. You know, I like these physics people. Always, have you noticed I have more physics people
on? Yes, you do.
I kind of have a sweet spot in my heart for that. From Vassar College in 1928, she got a Master's of Arts in Mathematics from Yale and a Ph.D. in Mathematics from Yale in 1934. By the way, she was the first woman to receive a Ph.D. in Mathematics from Yale.
Interesting.
She actually was, I mean, one of the reasons she's so special is that she really pioneered so many, she got into so many areas that women had formerly not been in, that she made a real impact in what she was doing. Her parents always believed that a woman should be able to do whatever a man could do, and they pushed her really in that direction. As a child, she loved gadgets. She always takes stuff apart. One time, there was this one story I was reading. She took apart the family's alarm clock, and then she couldn't get it together. So then she took apart another alarm clock to figure out how the first one should go together. By the time she was finished, she'd taken apart all seven alarm clocks in the house. Now,
my dog took apart one of my alarm clocks once using her teeth. We were not able to get that one back together.
Boy. Now, get this. In high school, she played basketball, field hockey, and water polo.
Marco.
Polo.
That's different. Water polo is different.
That's right. When working toward a Ph.D., by the way, you know, I was in Marco Polo's hometown where he was born. It was in Cortula. No, it was Croatia. Cortula.
Really?
Yeah, that's where Marco Polo was born.
Marco Polo was Croatian?
Didn't know that.
He would feel like he was more Venetian because that was owned by Venice then.
Oh.
And Croatia didn't exist then, but it was a city not far from Venice. So Cortula, that was where I stood right in the house where Marco Polo was born. And that's really not even relevant to this conversation, but
that's what happens when we interrupt you. We always wind up on another tangent.
I know. At age 23, she married Vincent Foster Hopper. That's where she got her last name. They divorced in 1945, 15 years later, and he was killed in World War II. She was an associate professor at Vassar College from 1931 to 1943. In 43, this is when her action with computers really began. After the breakout of World War II, she thought that she should serve her country. She was commissioned as a lieutenant and was ordered within the Navy and was ordered to the Bureau of Ordnance Computation Project at Harvard University in 1944. She became the first programmer on the Navy's Mark I computer. Now, Hopper just loved this Mark I computer. It was 8 feet tall.
Wow.
8 feet wide, and it was filled with all kinds of relays, switches, and vacuum tubes, just like that old alarm clock.
Certainly not the first laptop, it sounds like.
No, that's right. And, you know, she's famous for coining the word bug. This is sort of a, you know, an internet legend. I don't know how true it is. But she found a moth trapped in a relay in the Mark II computer.
Did we talk about that?
We did.
Yeah. That's the origin of bug.
That's the origin of a bug in the computer. Now, in 1946, she was released from active duty. She joined the Harvard faculty in the computation lab where she worked, where she continued to work, guess what, on the Mark II and then the Mark III. These were probably bigger and better.
Bigger, better computers.
Bigger and better. Then she joined Eckert-Mockley Computer Corporation, which was later called Sperry Rand, and helped them develop the first commercial computer, which was called UNIVAC.
Which, of course, is the same computer we use here at 3WT.
Yes,
that's
Sperry UNIVAC.
It's just getting harder
that's
and
right.
harder to find good tech support.
That's
though,
right.
Exactly.
You know, that's right. There's just one vacuum cleaner, and it's the UNIVACuum cleaner. You call it the UNIVAC, don't you? Okay, perhaps her best-known contribution to computing was the invention of the compiler in 1952. I mean, this is really quite significant, because up to that point, you'd write code for a program in assembly language or some sort of basic computer language, and she thought, wouldn't it be better if you could just write English commands and have something convert those English commands that people could understand into lines of code that the computer can understand. In other words, compile the English into machine language. So she invented the first compiler, which was an intermediate program that translates English language instructions into the language of the target computer. She was part of the Flowmatic team, which was actually trying to develop a business language so you could use the UNIVAC computer for business applications.
Mm-hmm.
Part of Flowmatic. I mean, they really needed to come with a better name. This sounds like...
Yeah. It just doesn't flow.
But it kind of goes with UNIVAC and then Flowmatic. It was all in... I mean, I don't know. I think their marketing department had something to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
She participated in the work which wrote the initial specifications for a common business language, which was called Common Business Oriented Language, otherwise known as COBOL, COBOL,
yeah.
Yes. And those specifications were published in 1959. It was actually, and the COBOL compiler was based on the compiler that she wrote, and she was instrumental in the development of these specifications. So she is known as the mother of COBOL.
Interesting.
She's also famous. I mean, there are a lot of stories about Grace Murray Hopper. Amazing Grace. She loved to teach. She was a teacher. She always carried around and talked about a nanosecond. She'd carry a piece of wire that was about a foot long, and she'd say, "Well, this represents a nanosecond, since that's how far light will travel in one nanosecond, about a foot. A nanosecond is one billionth of a second.
Mm-hmm.
It's 10^-9 seconds.
That's like really fast.
Yeah, it's a billionth of a second. And so she'd carry that around. And her most famous remark that everybody remembers, I didn't really attribute it to her until I started doing some research on her. She made this on a television program that was aired in 1983, and she said, "It's much easier to apologize than to get permission."
I think a lot of people operate under that premise.
That's right. She received the first Computer Sciences Man of the Year award.
Great.
See, this was before PC. Mm-hmm. Now we say Person of the Year. But back then, no.
Man
of the Year.
By PC, you mean personal computer.
Correct, personal computer. That's right. From the Data Processing Management Association in 1969, she was the first woman of any nationality to be made a distinguished fellow of the British Computer Society. She retired from the Navy at age 65, and I have to say, she didn't want to retire, but it was just the rules.
Yeah.
And then she went on to do some additional work, but what we really remember her for is her work on the compiler and COBOL.
Now, a couple of questions. First of all, the first we always ask is, did you get rich off any of this stuff?
She really didn't get rich, but she had a rich life. And she contributed a lot, but she wasn't, I don't believe she really capitalized on any of her investments.
Is she still around? She was born in 06.
No, she died in 1992.
It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by, more of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio.
IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here. And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. Today it is my pleasure and duty to administer the Pop Quiz as the adjunct professor for lowering academic standards at Tech Talk University. And we just finished speaking of Admiral Grace Murray Hopper, the mother of COBOL. She was always kind of a gadget girl. When she was a kid, she liked to take these apart. What were the things that she liked to take apart when she was a kid that kind of started her on her way in the technology field? If you know the answer to that question, you need to pick up the phone and call us now. If you're calling from east of New York City, the number is 877-936-9333. If you're calling from west of Yale University, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line for everybody else is 877-936-9333, the Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
You always hear about air traffic controllers and how the air traffic controllers are basically causing a traffic jam in the sky. Well, the interesting thing about air traffic control is we're basically using World War II technology.
Mm-hmm.
They're using radar to track the planes, just the same way Britain tracked the incoming planes from Germany by radar. Now, cars all have GPS systems.
I was going to say, we're much more technically advanced on the ground.
I mean, my son's got a GPS system on his racing bike.
I saw this thing in a couple of days ago in a catalog, GPS for dogs. To track your hunting dogs.
Good Lord.
And it'll tell you whether they're sitting, standing, or moving.
So what we have now in the air traffic control system is a system that really can't grow. Robert Stergel, FAA's deputy administrator, told the Senate committee last month that the current system cannot handle the projected traffic demands expected by 2015. What is actually happening now, it takes, for instance, about 36 seconds to get a fix on an airplane with radar. Now, at 500 miles an hour, that means a plane has traveled 5 miles before you locate them. So in order to keep the planes from running into each other, they're separated horizontally by 5 miles and vertically by 3 miles. Now, the pilots don't have any information about planes around them. All the data goes back to the traffic controller, who looks at this radar screen, and he says, Pilot A, would you move up a little bit? Pilot B, move down a little bit. And everybody is just following these guidance. Now, there's a new system out there that they're trying to implement, the next generation system for air traffic control, which uses GPS. It's a real simple idea. Every plane has GPS. It gets their GPS coordinates. It transmits to the control tower, as well as to all the aircraft in the area, its flight number, the flight information, as well as its location. Every airplane has an air traffic control display on it, and you can see all the other airplanes in the area. Guess what? You can get the planes closer together, and you don't have to have this centralized system that we have now. That's a so-called ADS. B, it's called the Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast System. And FAA is trying to get funding for this thing to get to get going. And, you know, as FAA is wont to do, they're a little bit slow getting off the stick here, and so people are criticizing them. Some of the airplanes are installing it on their own. They're just not waiting for the FAA. Mm-hmm. For instance, UPS Airlines, which, you know, they cargo carriers, they have already equipped 300 of their planes with this ADS-B technology. They're expecting that they can save almost 800,000 gallons in fuel annually because they'll be able to have more efficient approach pads.
And that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. It's going to pay for itself. Southwest is going to install a similar system next year. They're expecting to save a lot of money. We all want FAA to get off the stick. I think the airlines could pay for it. The skies could be a lot safer.
Safer, and to keep flight costs down and maybe bring down some ticket prices.
That's right. Did you ever wonder how GPS worked?
Absolutely.
Well, it turns out GPS stands for Global Positioning System. It's a worldwide navigation system which is formed from a constellation of 24 satellites and 5 ground stations. Now, these 24 satellites are actually operating at an orbit which is at a 55-degree angle from the equator, so that they cross over the North American hemisphere. These 24 satellites are called Navstar. They were made by Rockwell International. Each satellite weighs 1,900 pounds.
Navstar is also my vanity plate.
Really?
Wow.
Oh, Navstar.
You're cool, man. You're really cool.
You know, I never thought of that.
I bet the chicks really dig that, huh?
They yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. 17 feet with his solar panels extended.
Wow. Mr. Navstar over there.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
They have an orbital period of 12 hours. And they have a lifespan of 7.5 years. I'm trying to move on as fast
as okay.
I can.
Yeah, okay. I'll knock it off. I'm sorry.
They have ground stations in Hawaii, Ascension Islands, Diego Garcia, Kwajalein, I don't know how you pronounce that, and Colorado Springs.
Sounds good to me.
Now, what they do, you need 3 satellites to triangulate to get your position.
Triangulation
to get your position. And so, but then if you want to triangulate, you have to have the exact time, which means you need an atomic clock in your receiver, which is very expensive.
He needs some water. Would you get him?
I think he's been...
Coffee. I got coffee.
Been, that's the that's problem. Right. I think we've found the problem. Take the coffee away.
That's right. And so the time is a problem because you need a very expensive receiver to have accurate time. Well, they discovered if you have a 4th satellite, mm-hmm. you can derive the time from it. So if you use 4 satellites...
4 satellites, what happens to the triangulation?
It's a quadrangulation.
Okay. Oh, wow.
See, it's spatially triangulated. And so with the 4th satellite, you can derive the time, and that allows you to have an ultra-cheap GPS sensor without, and it gets the time from the satellites. So if you ever are in your car, you notice it takes a while for the GPS to turn on, you've got to lock in on 4 satellites. Once you lock in on four satellites out of the 24... Normally, 9 are in the horizon. When I've tracked them, I've seen up to 8. Because I have a little system that tracks the GPS satellites. And I've seen up to 8 or 9 at one time. Mm-hmm. But you only need 4 to really do it. So there's all you wanted to know about. Probably more than you wanted to
probably
know.
Probably more than you wanted to
know about GPS.
We're running a little short, so we're going to take a final break. Dr. Schertz, Jim Russ, and Navstar. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, heard in the Washington area, over the broadcast airwaves on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2, on the Internet worldwide at techtalkonline.com. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
T Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2.
So let's talk about a new device which was just announced, the USB condom. That protects your device, the USB condom. Now, have you ever noticed they've got these charging kiosks around, and you can plug your USB port into a charging kiosk to charge your cell phone? Well, the problem is the connections on that USB port not only have power connections, they also have data connections. And so there have been cases where there have been kiosks which have actually used that opportunity to upload malware into your phone or else pull data out of your phone. And so in order to protect you from that, they have what they call the USB condom, and you put your USB port into the condom and it blocks the data connections, and only the power connections are allowed to go through. This device is going. That's called juice jacking. if you plug it into a kiosk that tries to hijack your device, it's called juice jacking because you know it's a charging device. So this is going on sale, and it's built by INT3-CC, that's the company. Mm-hmm. It's going to be released and go on sale in the next month or so. So there you go.
Gotcha.
Two new iPhones went on sale on Friday the 13th. I don't know why they picked that.
That's a weird day, isn't it?
Yeah, Friday the 13th.
Oh, you know what? I should give the number. It's 877-936-9333. Sorry to interrupt.
You know, I was reading, there was, talking about Friday the 13th, there was this one flight that flies into Helsinki.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Yes.
Flight 666 to Hell.
Helsinki, which is H-E-L is the airport code,
that's
right?
That's right. On Friday the 13th. That's right. Well, after the iPhones were announced and went on sale on Friday the 13th, Apple shares actually fell because the analysts were wondering whether the iPhone 5C was cheap enough to compete on the Chinese market, and whether the iPhone 5S had sufficient increased capability to be worth the upgrade. And so they were a little, I guess the market showed somewhat disappointment. Now, the new 5C's plastic body was really the design choice of Apple's design guru, Sir Johnny Ives. And it was his attempt to produce a budget model. But actually, the budget model, it's only about $60 cheaper.
Right.
It's not really that much of a budget model.
No, it's still, what is it, 500-some bucks if you're just going to pay outright for it?
Yeah, it's just like $60, $70 cheaper. So that's why they're saying it's not that much difference.
Yeah.
But it has a plastic case. Now, the 5, the 5S has upgraded its camera. Now, this was really expected because there's a lot of competition in the sort of the camera space. It also added something that I like, a fingerprint scanner.
Yeah.
So you can actually lock your phone and you just rub your finger over the button when you want to open it. You don't have to put in the code, which is actually quite a nice feature. And you can also use the fingerprint as authorization for purchases from Apple's App Store. Also, it comes, this is very significant, with a more powerful 64-bit processor. That makes a big difference, especially for image processing. That means the 5S is just faster. It's got better, it's got as much computing power as a laptop or a desktop. Primarily, it's going to initially just be used on image processing and games, but later on, it's going to be, other applications are going to be written for it. Now, the 5C is available in 5 colors because they're trying to appeal to a different demographic,
sure,
including pink and green.
Mm-hmm.
The 5S is available in gold. So there is a marked movement away from Steve Jobs' favorite colors, black and white.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So I'd say Jobs would never have approved this color standard.
Interesting.
It turns out that gold is a popular color in China and India, and the plastic colors will further extend their brand in the West, that like all these bright greens and reds and pinks.
You know, some of the speculation I heard this week is some are saying that the cheapening thing could backfire on Apple, even though it's really not that much cheaper. But plastic, some of these other high-end firms that have tried to offer something that's not as good, it in the long run backfires. What do you think?
Yeah, it may not be successful. I really haven't had a chance to hold it. But Johnny Ives is a good designer.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of confidence in him, but I think they could have cheapened it in a way other than just with the case.
Sure, okay.
So let's look at what the iPhone 5S camera features are. This is the big deal. Okay, the sensor in the iPhone 5S is still 8 megapixels, but the individual pixels have been enlarged to 1.5 microns, which is up from the previous size of 1.4 microns. So a bigger pixel means that they collect more light, so you can do better low light pictures. So the active surface area of the sensor has been increased by about 50%, and that means they've got more light sensitivity. Now, Apple says this adds about a 33% increase to the overall light sensitivity. The iPhone 5S features a 5-element lens, which Apple described as new because it actually has to cover a larger chip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the lens is an aperture of f-stop of f2.2, which is a little bit faster than the previous phone, so you get about a 50% gain in terms of light on the system. So low light sensitivity is a big deal. Now, because of the processor, it's got some really sophisticated things. We have now dynamic tone mapping. Now, this means that it will, like in the dark area of the photograph, it will map the tone, and in the bright area, it will map the tone, so it increases the dynamic range.
Wow.
So, like if you've got a subject with a bright background, you can actually, you'll have a much higher dynamic range. And this has always been a problem with this, and only the high-end digitals had something else. It also has an autofocus matrix. That means it has focus zones, so it can zoom in quicker. It has a multi-shot feature, so it will take 3 or 4 pictures at once. It will pick the one that is the best in focus and keep it. And it can take parts of pictures and put them together dynamically. That's because of this LED. It has a true tone flash. It has 2 LEDs with two different skin colors, and it can dynamically adjust the tone of the flash based on the situation. It's got a burst mode, it's got slow motion video, and a new stabilization algorithm. Well, listen, this show is up. That's a great camera. Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. And we'd love you to check out the Stratford programs. Go to stratford.edu to check out those programs. You can also, at techtalkonline.com, you can sign up for the podcast. Or you can go to Apple iTunes and sign up to the podcast.
That's all we have time for this week. Hope you join us again next week for more Tech Talk Radio. Heard in Washington on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and online at federalnewsradio.com. We're brought to you by Stratford University. Learn more about them at stratford.edu. And everything you wanted to know about this show can be found at techtalkonline.com. Drop us an email. We'll answer your question right here on the air. See you next week on Tech Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of